This meeting is now being recorded.
Okay, so we're going to get started. We're adjusting our schedule a little bit to allow for Brian to get through more of the very helpful document. So we're going to do this for the next 60 minutes or so, and then we will move on to presentations because we have a two-hour segment here. So we'll split it in half and move on from there. So take it away, Brian.
Great. Thanks. So I think we should just jump right back into this. Are there any questions or comments before I get started on this approach? Anything to include? Okay, great. Okay, so now we're moving into these Spec 11/GAC advice or safeguards emerging from GAC advice, some represented within Spec 11, and how to measure each. So jumping right in, the first safeguard we'll want to look at is a requirement to use registrars under the 2013 RAA. In my notes, I have an underlying question that that this is essentially asking, is the 2013 RAA effective in terms of the safeguards it provides? That's my interpretation of it, which could be something of a hot potato, as I've indicated there. But I've flagged this as a kind of qualitative study, again, falling into some kind of perception of effectiveness survey or questionnaire. Does anybody have any thoughts on that? I think it's an important topic. I flagged it as a sort of high bang for buck if we hired a vendor or chose to focus on it. Carlos?
I'm not sure that what I'm going to ask makes sense. There were no changes to the 2013 agreement or the new end up signing new agreements. I'm bothered by the date.
The date.
The
okay.
2013. That was the version that existed before the new GTLDs were delegated?
I
can
Lauren,
that please. A little bit. So before, and any staff can jump in case I am wrong. There was a prior version of the registrar agreement. I think the last version before this was 2009. Of the 2013 agreement contained additional and different provisions that included numerous safeguards. And then there was a requirement for any registrar who was going to anyone who was going to have a new GTLD, that they would have to be bound by this agreement. And I think it's the registry agreement. Is it the registry or registrar? It's the registrar. Okay. So this is the agreement that, in fact, was required for new GTLDs registrars. So that's why it's being looked at, because prior to that time, this wasn't the key agreement. Karen, jump in if I'm misconstruing it.
Thank you. This is Karen Lentz. So the ICANN accredited registrars all have this same agreement, and that periodically gets updated and renegotiated. And so Lorena is correct. The last version that we had prior to new GTLDs was 2009. There was an effort already underway to update the RAA on, you know, the sort of usual process. And at some point during the new GTLD program development, there was feedback to the effect that, you know, one of the things that would help maybe address some of the concerns about expanding the space would be to apply these extra requirements to the registrars who would be selling new GTLDs. And then, you know, to the to the question that, that Brian's raising, I think it's correct that what you're, part of what you're asking here is the 2013 RIA effective? And I think that question is you know, in itself out of scope for this group. I think looking at, you know, including that as a requirement for the new GTLD space, did that make an appreciable difference, as opposed to what would have been required of all those registrars under the previous RIA? Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah. Drew?
Yeah, I was just going to comment on that. The parts that might be relevant, at least for context, though, of the 2013 RIA would be Section 3.18, which requires that registrars undertake a reasonable investigation into abuse complaints instead of waiting until law enforcement makes a formal request. And so different interpretations of that can lead to different anti-abuse policies and methods and responses. And so that might be something on the tail end when we're analyzing the data we want to just kind of point to, or maybe even bring up in any of the other categories in which we're actually holding focus groups of registrars to see,
okay,
understand their interpretation of that requirement. And then 3.7.8.
3.7, okay.
Which would be the, which we already discussed, but that would be the who is accuracy validation.
Okay. Carlos?
Thank you, Brian. Thank you, Drew. So if I understand you right, we don't want to know if they sign it. Everybody had to sign it.
Right.
The question is, how many cases do we have of 3.7 and 3.18? Is it right?
This is Drew again for the record. Yeah, and I mean, there might be, there could be interesting compliance data if there have been complaints filed against registrars for not following the 2013 RAA. So we'd be interested in those. But to Karen's point, you know, we don't want to get too lost in the weeds with the 2013 RIA for your exact point, because they were all required to sign it.
Yeah.
But yeah, but I think, yeah, we'd want to know if there are complaints overall about this. And then I think these two key provisions tie into other safeguards. And so that's where we would at least want to understand whether or not there's different interpretations of their requirements.
Okay. So it sounds like it'd be more useful to do conduct a study for context more than sort of an effectiveness, sort of hire a vendor and survey people kind of thing. Are people generally on board, Laureen?
Yeah, because this is Laureen for the record. I think it would be very difficult to ask this general question, was this, you know, effective, because it has so many provisions. So many provisions are different than the prior version. So I agree with Drew that it would be better to zero in on particular provisions, because otherwise I don't know how you would even, and I'm not a study expert, but I don't even know how you would control for the fact of, well, was it effective because of this provision, or was it effective because of that provision? And it would all have to be, of course, compared then to the RAA that was in effect prior. So it becomes it becomes a beast. Thank you. That's a good way to put it. So I think we really would need to focus. And then again, for this one, you have to figure out who your target audience is to ask about effectiveness. Is it, you know, is it IP enforcers? Is it law enforcement? Is it the registrar community? Is it internet users? So, you know, depending on who you ask, you're going to get very different answers. So I just think we need to consider those questions. Say it again? No, I didn't say that. I'm saying it depends. You will get a different answer to the question of whether it was effective depending on what group you ask.
I'm following the rules, David. Hi, sorry. David Taylor. So compliant, yeah. No, I just fully agree with that, because I think to look into the 2013 RIA would be a beast, which we'd want to steer well clear of. I'm just going to pick up on Drew's point, because I think that's an interesting one to home down on, the anti-abuse, policies of registrars. I'm just wondering how we'd look at that with 1,000-plus registrars and how we'd get anything meaningful. But I'm not saying not to do it. I'm just trying to figure out what next step would be on that.
In terms of the safeguard in general?
Yeah. With the registrar's policy, because obviously they may or may not differ, but how do we go around doing that? And is that maybe just a bridge too far for us?
Sorry. It's getting into that sort of beastly nature of the safeguard, and it becomes almost an entire study in and of itself, I would imagine. You could probably write a report on it. Ideas, Lauren?
You know, what I see as a general challenge, and that Brian's very useful exercise brings home to me, is that as Fiona said, we are not going to be able to do everything at this juncture. And really, one of our main tasks is going to be prioritizing what we can do now in the most effective way. So we may not be able to get at a study and information and recommendations on each and every one of these safeguards. So what I would ask people to think about as homework, because as you all know, I love giving you homework, and I know you love me for it. But what we should all think about as homework is really taking a hard look at how we are going to prioritize this, given our limited time and limited resources. What is really important? Brian has done a comprehensive look at all the safeguards, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we are going to be able to delve into each and every one, gather data on each and every one, and make recommendations on each and every one. We're going to have to be targeted, smart, and efficient in how we do it. So I'm just putting that out there so we can get the benefit of people's views on what are our priorities, what is really important here for this first look, you know, by our review team. There will be other review teams who are going to look at this. They'll have more data. They'll be at a different point in time, but we're the first, so what's really important? Feel free to respond.
All right, Carlton, for the record, for in my view, we'd look at, to me, what we're doing here is almost like with this business of safeguards and measurements. It's a clean slate. We're just building something. So I would recognize, and I agree with you, we should prioritize. We should prioritize around the ones that we have credible means of getting data, because we want to be evidence-based in all our things. And even the ones that we think would be useful in getting data for, even if we don't have data now for them, we should at least make sure that they are included in that list. And we tell them we just don't have the data. So I would err on the side of prioritizing those we have credible means of getting to the data and assessing the data. And the ones that even if we don't have data now, we should at least recognize them as important to the evidence-based response that we are projecting.
Great. Thanks. Thanks for that. Any other comments on – oh, David, please, go ahead.
David Terry, see, I'm compliant, but no one listens. No, I was just going to say maybe on that point of getting data – we could ask the registrar stakeholder group, and if we group this as a question with other things to them, then they may have some of that data on abuse policies and difference between the registrars, and any data is still worthwhile having, even if it's minimal.
Okay, great. That's very helpful. Any other ideas on data sources or how to approach this? Okay, let's move along to our next safeguard. This one's a bit of a bear too. Registry-specific public interest commitments, which is emerging from question 18 of the applicant guidebook. Are we familiar with this? at all, or is this? So okay, Karen, thank you.
This is Karen Lynn. So I just wanted to give some background on this one. You know, question 18 and the registry picks aren't necessarily related they're not the same thing. So back when we were developing the applicant guidebook, there was some advice from the GAC to the effect of, you know, there should be some sort of cost-benefit analysis incorporated into how the applications were being reviewed. And rather than incorporate that type of, you know, evaluation and assessment into the actual evaluation, the decision was to put a question in the application that asked the applicants themselves to describe, you know, what is their mission and purpose, why are they applying, for that TLD, and then it asked them about how they intended to, you know, create benefit for, public benefit, for their users or for, you know, the internet in general, and then, things, that they might do to minimize any social costs. And the goal with including those that question was to do a few things. One being to inform anybody that would be reviewing the applications for the purpose of deciding whether to file an objection, whether they wanted to issue an early warning or something like that. So the question was primarily educational. It wasn't scored. It wasn't evaluated in terms of whether an applicant passed or not. It was more of an essay question. And the you know, what the board response to the GAC comments on that was that it would be sort of more relevant as an exercise at a later point to look at the statement that they made at the in terms of the application and look at some of the sort of cost benefit discussions when you have some data about how the registry is using the TLD. And then the point about the registry specific picks, you know, seemed to us, you know, germane in some ways. So you had an applicant, writing something at the time they applied about what they intended to do with their TLD. In some cases where, when the voluntary picks were introduced, the registry had an opportunity to make additional public interest commitments. And so what they may have done in some cases would be to take, some of the things that they wrote about how they were going to, you know, create more benefit, and actually make that a commitment or part of its registry agreement. So you've got a set of TLDs, not all of them, but you have a set of TLDs that does have these voluntary commitments in their agreement. And so back to the IAG that recommended metrics that Jonathan was describing this morning, they did have this metric included in their recommendations, which was to essentially look at, do a qualitative study, I think were their words, to look at what the applicant said in question 18 and compare it with actual use of the TLD. And so we've, you know, done a few iterations of trying to figure out how you could do that type of qualitative study. So I think Brian's going to talk about a couple of the options. Hope that helped. Thanks.
Yes, thank you, Karen. Much better synopsis than I could have given. Yes, so essentially what we're doing, we're tasked with comparing their stated commitments in question 18 of the applicant guidebook with essentially how well they've maintained those commitments in actual practice, as Karen said, how they use the TLD. I'm sorry?
And what happens if you find a difference?
What
happens if you find a difference?
It's
a dispute.
That's one of our issues, is how meaningful the methods we've tried to use are, and we've done just some very preliminary research into just to see what a possible way to measure how effective these have been, and that's simply entailed reviewing a sample of responses to question 18, comparing that to what's stated on the TLD websites, and how much sort of similarity or difference there is. Now, of course, this raises the question of how meaningful that is, because are they just repeating what was said in the question 18 to sort of be consistent and look good? Does it demonstrate how they're actually committed to those picks? That in and of itself would involve a much deeper study. So we're a little bit at a loss for this one. It's not quite as easy as just telling a vendor to take care of it. It's literally just a very difficult issue to measure without, you know, delving into the nitty-gritty details of how a TLD is operated and interviewing people and sort of putting them on the spot with how they're committed to these picks. So that's the problem.
So let me go for the record, because I'm on record as saying that they weren't worth a bucket of warm spit. And the reason for that is very clear. They were voluntary. You have no way of measuring them because you're not committed to them. And even when you look at the amendments, those are ring-fenced. Picks, safeguards, they are ring-fenced in amendments to the registry agreements. So even if you found something wrong with it, and they said, well, there's a process. You got to go through mediation and arbitration and whatnot. And let's assume mediation and arbitration, you go to mediation and arbitration. There's a dispute. I say I'm going to do this. I say you didn't do it. So let's mediate. We can't agree. Let's arbitrate. We can't agree. You know what? The picks are ring-fenced. The picks are not part of the mediation and arbitration framework. They are actually outside of it in the amendments. The process. They give you a process. And they are not in it. And we knew this from a long time ago. So I can tell you, I didn't spend too much cycles on it. I was on the ALAC at the time when it came up. And I read the thing and I said, there are too many outs here for everybody. Not worth a bucket of warm spit. Still not worth it.
So I think you raised some important issues with the efficacy of the public interest commitments, how enforceable they are, and the whole public interest dispute resolution process, and whether that's even an effective method of enforcement or whether it's just a lot of time, complexity, and effort that doesn't end up with a defined result. So I think those are important issues. Separate and apart from that, with the issue, at least preliminarily, that Brian and Karen have identified, which is there a difference between what applicants for GTLDs said in their application and what they are actually saying on their websites? And that's separate and apart from what they actually do in practice. I'm going to section that off because that is a real beast. But I would say just at a threshold level, maybe we could at least see if there's a difference between the application and the public-facing website. That might be something we can actually do and get information on. Actual practice, maybe that is a lot more challenging and resource-intensive, although you know, more important, actually, because, of course, we care more about what people do rather than what they say they do. But in terms of what we can actually study, maybe it's just that first part that we can actually study. And just as a placeholder, Carlton, the whole issue of the PICs and the dispute resolution process, that's been a big topic of GAC advice, which when we get to our reports on data sources, GAC advice, which is one we'll be focusing on a little more.
Yes, I think this is very important, and I can see three cases where this is relevant. When different people applied for the same community TLD and it has not been assigned,
Okay. This is very important. The second one is when somebody who didn't get the domain name is in an IRP against ICANN and is using these type of arguments in the IRP. And the third one is when the business model of the domain name fails and somebody wants to buy it or to save it and might use the argument that he's going to change the purpose of the domain name or the picks where the barrier to success, he wants to take it over but use it differently. So I don't know how to deal with that at this stage, but having been in the GAC when this was discussed, this is a very relevant issue. And the problem being that the semantics of public interest aren't still defined in ICANN adds another level of complexity because ICANN has promised to the community to develop some semantics, let's say, on public interest and the words being used in the new bylaws, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not sure that shooting in the direction that you propose right now, just comparing the web page with the commitments, is useful. It's a minimum. But this is certainly something we have to think about. And if we don't solve it this time, just make a note that we have to say, oh, we didn't solve this one. We're leaving it for the next review team because this is very relevant.
Actually, it's quite relevant what Lorraine says because the first two mentions that you propose, that was what the discussion was in the at large. There were a couple of the applicants who made commitments, and then if you look at what came out on the website, there was this distance between them. So to me, having that figure as a baseline is very important. I mean, I know that I'll have to ask Garth. A couple of them did some checks, and I know Garth and Evan were very much involved in doing the checks, and I'll have to ask. There is a document somewhere in circulation in the at large with some of that data, a very small set. But they were used as arguments for why it was important to have a more robust enforcement element with regard to the PICs. So I actually endorse doing that top level look, Lorraine, and just look at what they said in the application, look at what they have published subsequently.
This is Brian. For the record, I mean, I think this is a very useful discussion just to get your sort of personal insights into the process is in and of itself an insight into the efficacy of the program, and I think that might make this study a candidate for sort of some interview-based kind of studies, pulling people aside to discuss just those kinds of things that you talked about. So I will flag that as a potential method. Karen?
Thanks, Brian. Karen Lentz, this is just, again, to kind of clarify the terms. When we're talking about question 18, these aren't commitments. This is looking at the applicant's responses at the time they applied versus a future, you know, operation. And I think I'm going to suggest that we actually tried to make this two lines, like one on question 18 that responds to that metric, and the second one on PICs themselves. And then if you do the research on both, then you can look at synergies between them. And for the second point, I think, as Carlton is pointing out, there's a lot that you can look at. You've got a smaller set of registries that have PICs, and then you have the GRP and complaints and, you know, other ways of looking at the effectiveness of the PIC approach.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Okay. Great. Okay. Any other comments on this? I know I'll have to kind of digest some of that too before we can reach a conclusion. Carlos?
Yes, I mean, there is, the GNSO is in a discussion with the board on the follow-up and definitions and so on, and letters are exchanged regularly. So there is a very close follow-up. Who is going to make the definition of the public interest, if it's going to be the executive or if it's going to require policy development and so on. So you can be sure that there are some stakeholders following the issue of the responsibility of public interest very closely. So you have to include or mention that this is a parallel process.
Okay.
Don't get bogged down.
Okay, great. Okay, to move along, these next two, next three, well, all of them, but let's just focus on the next two. We might just need to put a pin in, or that's my initial thinking. So we have included within Spec 11 a prohibition of abusive activities, which it prohibits phishing, malware, these kinds of malicious conduct activities that we're all aware of. Following that, there was a provision that the registries have to conduct a periodic statistical analysis of security threats. The standards for those analyses have not been developed. There's not really much to measure there in that sense. Also, the prohibition of abusive activities, it seems like it's just kind of saying, don't be a bad guy, be good. I would probably throw that in maybe a vendor perception of effectiveness bucket, but I'm at a loss on these two. So, Carlos?
Yes, this sounds very similar to a segment of five or six questions on these issues in the AIG or IIG. I don't know. I always get it wrong. But the IAG, there is this specific section of IAG asking for very close follow-up of the reports of this type of incidents.
Mm-hmm.
So whoever does it internally or externally, I have no opinion, but it should converge with that.
Okay. My sense of this is, should we kind of put a pin in these for now and just say that we were awaiting development of these reporting standards, before we can really study it effectively and provide some kind of description, or
in this case, we are also responsible for the other one. So I think we can do it for the very short term, but we cannot go out in 3 months with that explanation.
Okay,
because we are also it's part of our duty to see the implementation of these indicators and so on. So in this case, it's totally internal. So we have to find a solution before we write something publicly.
Okay. So it comes down to Karen, go ahead. Thanks.
Thanks. This is Karen Lentz. I think maybe there are two things we're interested in here, looking at specification 11. So, you know, the first is obviously what are the levels of activity that this is trying to guard against, phishing, malware, et cetera. So we've talked about that already, looking at, you know, what information we can glean about the rates of those things. But the provision in Spec 11, I think that we're talking about, is talking about the registry including in its agreement with registrars, a requirement that the registrar must then include this provision in its agreement with domain name registrants, right? So I think, you know, part of what you're looking at, you know, on one level here is, you know, has there been an impact on those activities because of the requirement that this, you know, specific provision be included in the registration agreement where as opposed to, you know, the terms that a registrant would have agreed to before. which strikes me as a very difficult study. But, you know, there's one piece of this that we're obviously interested in, which is the rates of these types of abusive activities. And then the second point, as it regards to this safeguard in Spec 11, is the effectiveness of having this requirement to include this specific language.
Karen, please, I need a clarification. By including it, the registrars are supposed then to produce the reports and then avoid the situation that Jordan mentioned. They don't give us any data. So we will have monthly reports or yearly reports from the registrars. So it's not only putting it in the contract and signing it, but then complying, at least writing, no, we had no incidents, even if it's a lie, but or not.
So in terms of the registrar requirement, are you talking about, you know, what's in the RAA, the new RAA to report, or?
Yes, in terms of the report.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. But that's it's not in what I'm looking at in terms of Spec 11. So it's so it's another point that you could note. Yeah, and then also in Spec 11, which is probably the next thing, is about the registry, which does have to conduct this analysis of activities in its TLD and provide reports. As Brian mentioned, the framework for that reporting is still being discussed.
Right.
I think.
So sometimes I like to reduce things to for simplicity's sake. There seems to be still a fundamental question in terms of efficacy. That needs to be asked. Did this prohibition of abusive activities have some kind of marked effect on a DNS abuse rate, right? Which seems a bit of not a silly question. I mean, it's an important question, but it's kind of like asking, did making bank robberies illegal decrease the amount of bank robberies? I mean, it's one of those things that's comes down to a deterrent effect. Is this having some kind of deterrent effect because there's language in the agreement? Oh, I'm not supposed to be a bad person. I wasn't aware before the 3A of Spec 11. Carlos?
If in one jurisdiction the law enforcement agency comes and takes the site down, then yes. Does it apply to the whole domain name? No, because it's generic. It's all across the world and so on. But if it's enough for one judge in one place, even Pakistan, whatever, to say, okay, there is grounds because supposedly they signed an agreement with ICANN that they wouldn't do it, but they did it, I take it down. I mean, Brazil did it the other day with WhatsApp. I mean, WhatsApp is not a domain name, but
right.
It's an application, but it, if it happens, then there is a good argument for the judge, even if he doesn't know much about that, if he would get the information from somebody complaining, listen, this guy signed an agreement with ICANN, he would do it, he did it, and then they take it down.
Yeah.
There is the result very difficult to follow up, I agree.
Yeah.
Very far away from the responsibilities and the remit of ICANN, but yes, it's relevant. I see it coming.
So to me, the key question for us is how do we measure this? You know, Carlos, your point. I mean,
I was answering his
yeah.
Question.
Okay. Fair.
Right,
and I think we all can come up with intuitive, as Carlos did, what would be the benefit here. But if we're going to want to have the heft of some data behind it, I think we're still faced with the question of how do we measure this? I'm not sure I've heard a great answer to that yet. I think it's a very complicated question. Well, no, I'm gonna disagree there because just from a law enforcement perspective, I'm not gonna take something down because someone's violated a private contract. ICANN's in charge of enforcing its contracts. As law enforcement, I'm going to take something down because there's evidence and a law has been violated. That's how a government agency is going to work. The fact that there's contracts that have been violated, that's not my purview as a government agency. That's for the parties to the contract to deal with each other. So I would disagree that that's going to be something we can really look at. In terms of deterrence, you know, that's a different question. Is this a deterrent? Are people more deterred because it's in the contract? Are people more apt to behave in a legal manner or a, you know, worthy manner because of it? That's a different question.
Right. Calvin?
Yeah, I went through the takedown report, and takedowns don't really apply to domain names so much as content and web hosting as opposed to registrars and registries. So to link the two together, to link content with the actual domain name, you're starting to get into something where there isn't a cause and effect there, I think.
Mm. Right. Okay. And just in the interest of time, I'm going to sort of move us along, and we'll just, you know, sleep on this and think about it. We're going to come back to this. So some great ideas will come to us. So I keep a notepad by my bed. So it's usually when my ideas come to me. Okay, so here's a bit of a similar kind of safeguard, but it was a requirement to operate the TLD in a transparent manner. Not easy to measure any of that. What is transparent? Is it being followed? Is it being followed as a result of the safeguard being included as a safeguard? Again, it's kind of my early thinking was that it's essentially a zero-sum phenomenon. It's either there or it's not, and we have to find some way to define transparency. Does anyone know, are there any sort of definitions for what that means to operate the TLD in a transparent manner? Is that, Karen? Thanks.
Well, just to read the full text of that provision, it says they'll operate the TLD in a transparent manner consistent with general principles of openness and non-discrimination by establishing, publishing, and adhering to clear registration policies. So there's a little bit, you've got some more judgments there about what's clear or adhered to, but you can at least check that there is a registration policy and that it is available to people, the public, on their website. So that's one aspect of it.
Yeah, Faber here. For transparency, we can consider three criteria. The first one is that information is somehow public at some stage, not all stages, but some stages is public. The second one is public participation, that at some stage all the stakeholders can come in and participate somehow. And the third one on accountability. There are, at some stage, mechanisms for people to criticize and comment on that and some public reviewing processes. So if the three ones, transparency, participation, and accountability, it's achieved, it would be.
Great. Did you have that written down? Because that was perfect.
I'm the auditor for the Open Government Partnership in Brazil, so these are the criteria for
okay.
I send you out the three things.
Okay, great. Thanks for that.
So just a quick response.
Sure.
I really appreciate what you said, Fabro, that those are all three very important criteria, but I do wonder if the accountability and the sort of ability to comment go to transparency or go to something else. They're very important, but I'm not sure it's transparency. So I just, you know, reflect that observation that when we're talking about transparency, to me that's visibility, do I know about it, not whether I can comment on it and whether they'll change it if I, if I make them aware of it. That's very important, and I think that to me is accountability, but not necessarily transparency.
Yeah, Fabro here. Good point. The one thing we can use in the literature review, there's analysis of how many people access the ICANN webpage. So maybe when you give transparency, so when you put online how much use you have, so maybe you have some analytics or how many times this process is accessed by others than the stakeholders applying for the process itself, maybe.
Yeah.
Good ideas. This is Brian again. Any other comments on this in terms of method? I think we might have to delve a bit deeper before we start thinking about methods. Okay. So, moving along, we have another safeguard. No exclusive registration criteria for generic TLD strings. This is emerging from GAC Category 2 advice. I've seen this as another qualitative study. It does seem, again, to be a bit of a zero-sum question. Just for a bit of context, in the application process, those applications that did drop, they were required to drop exclusive registration policies. If they wanted to proceed with the application, 184 out of 186 did, and the others were deferred to a next round. I have to admit I'm not very familiar with this safeguard, so I will defer to anyone who may be in terms of how to measure it or ideas. Laureen?
So this, as I understand it, this really is, to me, bears on competition issues rather than consumer trust issues because, again, as I understand it, and that's my caveat, this deals with whether a generic name like, say, I'll just pluck out, let's say, .dog, okay? If it's a sort of generic name like that, the GAC advised, for these generic names, we don't want people saying just owners of Pekingese dogs can apply or just owners of Pedigree dogs can apply. We want everyone to be able to, if they want to, buy a .dog domain. And that, to me, it's really a competition issue that you shouldn't have to have restrictions on who can scoop up these generic domains. And as such, I'd say it falls outside of what we're really looking at. Yes, it's a safeguard, but it's not a consumer trust safeguard, as I'm understanding it.
Right. Music and hotels.
Well, that's great. I mean, if we can eliminate some of these and, you know, pass it over to the other team, then, I'm all for that. So, does anybody disagree with that assessment or have another idea on it? Okay, good. Now, we have GAC Category 1 safeguards. I think we might be a little more familiar with this. I had them in a footnote. Let me change my view here, I think. Okay, well, they must have disappeared. Ah, there they are. Can we see these? Oh, that's probably... Let's see if I can zoom. Right.
Yeah.
These are safeguards dealing with highly regulated sectors and some special safeguards. You can see a list of them here. I've categorized it one safeguard in the matrix, but you can see it's actually eight different safeguards. But a lot of them fall into this don't be a bad guy kind of safeguard. Comply with all applicable laws. Make sure that registrants know to comply with these provisions. So some of the, I think, more interesting ones to perhaps focus on would be registrants collecting sensitive financial and health data must secure that data properly. That might also fall into a discussion of, an HSZ framework, a high security zone framework, if that doesn't confuse things. For highly regulated sectors, they're to publish a point of contact to facilitate relationships with relevant regulatory bodies. Registrants need to provide contact information, possess licenses for their sector in which they're operating, and consult with authorities on credentials and credential authenticity complaints and report updates and changes to credentials. So I think there's a lot to study here and a lot that's important, but is it how do we see this as a priority? Laurie?
So I think that this actually is I think it's really important, but I also think it's really challenging because there was a lot of GAC safeguard advice given. Not all of that advice was accepted. And the credentialing advice of highly regulated sectors is the best example of advice that was not accepted. So if it isn't accepted, how can you measure it? At least on that point, there are some domains that have voluntarily restricted their registration policies in highly regulated sectors. Certainly that's something we can look at. But it's very important to understand that not all of this advice was actually taken, so it's not a requirement, and we need to be very, very precise in how we are describing the reality, so to speak, because we can't go forth and assume that all of these safeguards were actually implemented, because many of them were not.
So the first step would be to ID which ones were implemented.
Yes.
Okay. Since we're running short on time, I'll just flag that. So again, think about it. Keep that notepad next to your bed. And okay. So now we're moving into rights protection safeguards. A bit of a different animal, I have to say I'm not as familiar with these safeguards as I am with, the DNS abuse safeguards, but I know some in the room are. So let's just jump in. We have a trademark clearinghouse that was implemented as a safeguard. I've flagged this as something we could perhaps survey people on who've used the service and its efficacy, but open to thoughts on how to review the effectiveness of the trademark clearinghouse. Karen?
Thanks, Brian. This is Karen Lentz. Just wanted to point out a few data sources here. One is there's a currently in process an independent review of the Trademark Clearinghouse, which was something that was recommended by the GAC about 5 years ago. So that's being undertaken currently, and that includes looking at aspects of the clearinghouse and how it operates, as well as the Sunrise and Claims services, which are underneath there, which it supports. So that's one thing. We expect that report to be available in Q3 of this year, so July-August timeframe. And then a second source here is, one of the first sort of preparatory exercises we did for this review team was to compile the data that we had on the RPMs. And seek public comment on kind of the aspects that people believed were working well and areas that perhaps could be improved. So if you go back to the what we called it the RPM review report, it looks at, for example, how many marks are in the clearinghouse, what different countries are they from. How many Sunrise registrations have there been across CLDs? So there's a lot of specific data points that you have that will go to pretty much everything in this bucket, you've got at least some initial data there to start with.
So will this independent review, will this not just kind of tick that box? Can we just draw on that, the results from that?
Well, this is Karen Lentz. They're not, they're not being tasked to answer the question of, was this effective at protecting rights in the program. There are certain things that they're asked to look at, such as the matching rules, how long the claim service lasts, and certainly it will touch on, pretty much everything that this group considers most likely. But that review is informational. So it's being done by a contractor called Analysis Group, and they're not going to make recommendations as to what I can, should or should not do in terms of the trademark clearinghouse. So it's, it gets to a lot of the information, but it doesn't really do the same job.
So my thinking on this is that, again, it might be useful to have a survey. I know, just to survey the people who have used the trademark clearinghouse and get an idea of the effectiveness through that method. If there's any other ideas for how we can measure, of course, combined with what's produced in the TMCH report. If there's any other ideas on that, I'll kind of flag that as discussed for now. Carlos?
It's a question for Karen, because I don't know enough about this. I need a benchmark or a comparison, like, okay, we do this and we hope that by having used the trademark clearinghouse, we will have less UDRPs in the future or things like that. I miss like a contact with the past or something like that. I don't know if it makes sense, but.
Thank you, Carlos. This is Karen Lentz. It's a good question to look at sort of the initial goals of the clearinghouse, why people proposed it and why we implemented it. It was proposed by a stakeholder group called the IRT that was looking specifically at how to build some trademark protection mechanisms into the program. And so some of the goals that they included in their report would be, for example, to create some efficiencies. So if I'm a trademark holder, I used to have to go to every time a new TLD started up and had a sunrise, I'd had to go prove my trademark all over again. Sometimes provide, one set of documents, sometimes provide a different set of documents. And so one of the things that the clearinghouse was intended to do was to, you go one place, you have your mark verified, and then all you have to do is sort of show your credential every time you go to register a sunrise name. So that's one aspect of it. Creating efficiencies on the registry side too, so that they don't have to do the checking of trademarks and assessing whether they meet the certain requirements or not, which could potentially save them some costs. So there were several goals. I don't know if David wants to elaborate, but when looking at this question of whether it was effective, it's really helpful to go back to the reasons it was initially proposed.
So David Taylor, I won't elaborate too much, or else. We won't have any time for everything else, but I fully agree with that. And the only thing I would say is that it was interesting because right at the very beginning, one of the big discussions is should we make the trademark clearinghouse mandatory or not? And we were divided on that. I had a personal view and some thought yes, some thought no. And I think that's a kind of a fundamental question for going forward, which will tie into whether we think it was worthwhile and whether it's been successful or not. So, as Karen says, the independent review is perfectly timed to Q3. Wasn't it due? So, ideal. Couldn't have planned that one better.
Okay, so we're getting to the end of our time. So maybe I can ask you to just conclude for now, so we can turn over to our exploration of our readings.
Yeah, it's. I think it'll be good to take a break. I think it's hard to really think about all of this on the fly. So what I'll do is I'll polish this up, provide sort of a neat record of our recommendations as far as we have them. And then if you could just read, there's a few more boxes, probably, about six, seven. So maybe read through them and just, for now, just have a think about them, have them in the back of your mind, as to, again, how to measure effectiveness, which is really what it all boils down to. So, I appreciate very much your time on this. It's been incredibly helpful for me, to try to get my head around, potential methods, and, I hope it's been helpful for you. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Brian. This has been very, very helpful, and I look forward to revisiting this. So we're now going to change orientation. Alice, if I can ask you to put our Google spreadsheet. The next time we're scheduled to take a break is 3:45. So we're not going to take a break where we go outside now. But in the interest of clearing our heads, what I would say is that maybe we can all just stand up. This is going to be a standing break. right. I'm going to actually lead everyone in just a few stretches so we can clear our minds and kind of get our faces out of our heads. Yeah, we can, if you want to record it, you can, or you can shut off the recording.
No.
Well, you can make sounds, David. So just everyone, if you can bring up your shoulders and let them down, because that's where we carry all our attention, our shoulders and our necks and our brains, our very busy brains. Shrug up, shrug down. Oh, good. So those sounds are my appreciation. And if you can lift your arms up, take hold of one of your wrists, lift up and stretch to the side. Just a little stretch.
Actually video it.
Stretch back up. Other side. Up and then over.
No.
Then arms out and down.
Breathe.
Exactly. We're going to breathe. We're going to take a deep breath. Stretch up and out.
Thank God.
Sorry, that's not loud. What I want to know is, how do you capture that in your section of the report?
And we're going to do a little bit, couple of neck stretches. So start off by letting your head drop down. Your head weighs about 8 pounds, so you're holding it up all day. Give it a rest. Breathe. Then go over to one side, just over the shoulder. Another breath. And down. To the other side, the other shoulder. And down. And lift your head up. Shake out your hands. Forget your troubles, get happy. And now we can get back to work.
And this is what happens with the U.S. government oversight. Do we have fresh coffee?
If anyone needs to, grab a cup of... Yeah.
Oh.
Yes. Sure, that's fine. Okay. Okay, so we're gonna get back to our reading list. Just a show of hands, not to put people on the spot, but just to know who I can call on. Who in the room has filled out the Google document reporting your findings? Who in the room has done that? Okay.
Not everything.
Not everything, that's fine. Okay, so we have a lot of people who have done it. That's great. For folks who haven't done it, I encourage you, strongly encourage to do that so we can have the benefit of your findings on this document. But what I'd like to do is start off our presentations, and I think I'm going to do it just by person. Everyone has about 5 or 6 or perhaps 7 articles that they were assigned. Thanks to those of you who volunteered for your preferences. That makes my task a lot easier. And we'll just go person by person by person. So we're going to keep it short, but what I would really like to hear is, as Jonathan said, how your data source relates to the prism of our review team focus, i.e., how your particular article relates to our task of thinking about whether the new GTLD program has had an effect on consumer trust. So is there someone who would like to start us off? Thank you, Drew.
So least I could do after all that yoga and feeling energized. This is Drew Bagley for the record. I'll just run through the articles saying exactly that, how the context of what should be applicable here with our research and our study. So the first one that I...
And maybe we can, whoever has ownership of the screen, maybe we can scroll down to Drew's section.
Yeah, if you want to do find, you could search for my name. Otherwise, the one I'm going to go over first would be the Secure Domain Foundation report.
And for those who haven't put their findings in this document yet, what I'd encourage everyone to do is put their articles serially, i.e., in, you know, just find a place in the chart and then just put
all
your stuff in a row.
There goes Lorene, Jamie Carlton, and then me, I think. So I think I'm right under Carlton. Getting close. That's not me. I did attribution.
Yeah, that is the anonymous person.
All right, there I am.
There you go.
All right, so, yeah, for the first article, the Secure Domain Foundation report, what I found most applicable for us, since this was a survey-based report that actually interviewed registrars, this is a bit of what I was referencing earlier. I thought it was interesting that the registrars differed from one another in how they interpreted their own responsibilities under the 2013 RAA, and I thought that was what was most applicable for us, and so this would be a report we might be interested in citing for at least those purposes because it demonstrates evidence of that and what that interpretation leads to in practice is a difference in how different registrars deal with abuse reports and what they're willing to do about anti-abuse in general, whether they're checking for bad things before it's reported for them or whether they're waiting for a specific complaint to actually go ahead and do an investigation. And when they do an investigation, what they're actually doing in terms of that investigation. Similarly, this report also describes a bit of the who is verification and how that can differ from registrar to registrar and what they're doing for that. For the next one, or does anybody have any questions about that? Sorry. Okay. For the next one, and the next couple deal a bit with similar topics. The next one was about amplified DDoS attacks,
just explain terms just to make sure.
Sure. So amplified distributed denial of service attacks. And so what this was an interview by ICANN's own Carlos Alvarez of cybersecurity experts and was looking at ways to mitigate these types of attacks. So this was not necessarily directly applicable to the new GTLD program. However, what I thought was applicable so therefore, this would not necessarily be a resource we would cite in our report, but the main takeaway from this would be that we would want to, once we're doing that massive DNS abuse study, we'd want to look in there to see if new GTLD operators themselves, so the registries, have actually been affected by DDoS attacks. Also, what this would lead us to look into, as well as the subsequent reports I'll go over, would be some of these DNSSEC issues and whether or not what percentage of top-level domains versus second-level domains are DNSSEC signed. But this piece primarily dealt with things that ISPs could do as opposed to domain name registries. Do you have any questions on that one? Yes.
Thank you very much. I think it's very important what you said, that some of the documents here we have to enjoy and keep in the back of our minds, but they are really not related to the purpose of the report, particularly when they don't focus on DNS issues directly, because that happened with two of my four papers. Thank you.
Fabro, for the record, Drew, one idea I had reading the two combined is that there's a reputation from registrars that for some is quite important. And then when you connect with what we heard from Nielsen's review, user doesn't pay too much attention for that. They usually trust the source, and they trust the industry to kind of regulate our antivirus program softwares. So maybe we can think in a way to give publicity for reputation of registrars in a more centralized way. It's not a metric we can use, but it might be a way on how reputations of them are compared to each other. If I'm good, I'll say I'm good, but if I'm bad, I'll probably say nothing. So eventually, if you have a public record of reputation based on the metrics, might be a good way to enhance what they say, that increased costs, why they would do it, because they get reputation. Just throwing ideas.
Yes, to respond to that, I think that's a very good point you brought up, and I kind of glossed. I didn't even mention that. But in that first report, that was one of the takeaways, too, from the surveys, was that registrars do care about their reputations, and that they even spend resources making sure that they're responding to bad things that are said about them in online forums or with a Better Business Bureau and so on. And so along those lines of what you're suggesting, after we conduct this big study, I imagine we might have thoughts one way or another about what role ICANN security or ICANN compliance can play in ongoing studies of DNS abuse, particularly with regard to reputations, for purposes of seeing if there is a TLD operator that always has 90% bad domain names. And, you know, that's always publicized, so then the public is made aware as a consumer trust issue. Because what happens anyway these days is you can potentially get entire TLDs that are blocked if they're untrustworthy. So, for example, the cctld.su for Soviet Union, you know, some recursive DNS operators will completely block that domain name, or .tk is the other famous example from years past. And so exactly what you were inferring could definitely come up with new GTLDs if a particular one is known to be bad.
And one idea maybe what we can measure, when you're talking about safeguards, we spoke about privacy. And then one of the ideas was to survey how many registrars have a private policy in their websites or publicly available. Maybe here, just throwing ideas, we can see how many registrars actually respond or have a room for public response to complaints, because they complain that one of the things that I read said that to file a complaint like website is really difficult. Not saying I agree with that. But then ICANN is one venue for complaints, and then maybe our registrars playing a role as a complaint venue, so we can survey how many of them publicly let people publicly comment on that or have a link to send comments.
Yeah, those are some good ideas about ways in which the public could be educated on the reality, because what we're talking about this morning was perception, and then with our data we're trying to get to the reality, and that might be a way to marry the two in the end. So I like your way of thinking. The next report was an old one from 2005, next article, and it was a brief one on DNS cache poisoning. And so DNS cache poisoning can take place in a variety of ways. It could be on your local machine, and so that your machine is not truly querying the right IP address when you're typing in a domain name, so you're not being routed to the right domain name because the DNS cache on your computer has been corrupted, or this could potentially affect an actual DNS resolver. And so what these issues deal with are directly consumer trust. So if a consumer can't trust that when they type www.icann.org into their browser that it'll truly go to the real ICANN website, then that's a huge consumer trust issue. So this is something where I don't, since this was a very old article, it did not deal at all with new GTLDs, and I have not read enough yet to know if there are any issues that are specifically unique to new GTLDs as opposed to just all GTLDs, and I couldn't think of any. But if anyone has any thoughts on anything that could be unique to new GTLDs in this area, then we should look into that. Okay, and then the next one was, the next report I read was the WHOIS accuracy reporting system. Well, it was a link to their web page was on the reading list, so then I read the reports on there. There's a new report forthcoming this month, and so that might be the one that we would want to look at. We talked about WHOIS accuracy already and how that in and of itself is not going to be a beast that we are going to tackle because there are initiatives such as this going on. But something that I found to be interesting is that with all of the talk we do, we have about the 2013 RIA versus the 2009 RIA, 97% of domain names today or as of last fall were actually operating under the 2009 rules due to different grandfathering mechanisms. And so that left such a small data set of domain names actually operating under the 2013 RIA and that would actually be worth looking at. And so we have that with obviously other areas too, such as the similar number of 3% for the second level domain names that are signed with DNSSEC. But that's something where perhaps with the vendor data, and Brian, I'd love to hear your thoughts, maybe we would get the vendor to look at just that 3% slice and see what we could draw in terms of the 3% of domain names that are actually under the 2013 RAA versus the whole other universe of domain names to see if there's any correlations we can draw.
Hi, this is Brian, for the record. Could you sort of restate the question?
Yeah, I'm sorry. So this is dealing with WHOIS accuracy,
right.
Which in and of itself, as we've mentioned, might not say something one way or another about abusiveness. If
mm-hmm.
a bad guy uses terrific syntax and an email address that works and someone else's real address, then they're going to pass all of the qualifications mm-hmm. with flying colors for the WHOIS requirements. But with that said, since this report does point out the fact that 97% of domain names today, even if they're new GTLDs, are somehow finding their way operating under the 2009 RAA,
mm-hmm.
I was suggesting that perhaps we could look at the 3% of domain names that are actually operating under the 2013 RAA as our little slice of WHOIS accuracy, perhaps.
Right.
Either way, we would want to wait until this June report comes out to see what's in that.
Yeah, just a general comment. I think segmentation is always a good approach, and I won't say any more than that. But, yeah.
Drew, I'm looking at your next note here that there doesn't appear to be a difference in the 2009 RIA-based accuracy of who is data over legacy new GTLD data. Do you mean there's not a difference in the requirement under the RAA, or there's not a difference in the stats?
So this study only applied the 2009 metrics to the because of the fact that 97% of domain names were under the old rules. They only used the old rules as the baseline for their study, and so then you applying the 2009 requirements, there are such similarities between the two classes of domain names. Versus if you use the 2013 RIA metrics, I'm sure you'd come up with a different conclusion. And so, for example, I'd have to actually look back at the report itself, but I just didn't think it was relevant for our purposes. But, you know, postal addresses maybe was lower in one than the other, but then email addresses was about the same or whatnot. So as a whole, I just didn't think the particular phase one and phase two reports were applicable to our study, except for noting what a small percentage of domain names today actually are falling under the 2013 RIA. If nobody has any other questions, I'll go on. The next thing I don't have any notes for is the entire list of RFCs, so I have not had a chance to read through them all to see what would be applicable to us, but I do want to take the time to do that, so I'll have to come back to that one. So the request for comment that have created all of these wonderful standards that we have today, and so the link on the website went back to the entire index for all of them. Yeah. So, unless I looked at the wrong link on my reading list.
You can't possibly go through all of those.
No, I'm going to go through the index, see what might be applicable to safeguards, and then would skim those. But yes, I'm not going to read every RFC.
They have them by topic.
Yeah.
But it's going to take you a while to just go through all of them.
So what I would say in general with our reading list is if something seems monumental and of perhaps a questionable value given the time it would take, then make a reasonable decision about what makes the most sense for everyone, because I've gone through to some of these links also, and, you know, you might get a big surprise.
So the next one was the DNS Stability, Security, and Resiliency report, and this definitely could be used as a primary source when we're looking at the DNSSEC adoption issues. However, I didn't categorize this in the traditional hypothesis research conclusions tabs because I thought that was pretty much the applicability for our purposes. It's the ICANN one, and that's the exact title of it if you Google. I can paste the link into the box. Yeah, I don't have the document that has the URL up, so I apologize for that. But here, I think I found it. Yeah, I can paste this in. So if you wanted to look at that. But yeah, so the primary relevance for us will just be as we're looking at the DNSSEC signing issues, because this goes into the importance of DNSSEC, what it does, and just the stability of the DNS system as a whole, but that would be the part I found to be most applicable to new GTLDs in particular. And then the, did you have a question, Carlos? Sorry. Oh. And then the Registration Abuse Policies Working Group final report. I believe this was from 2010. I'd have to go back and look at it again. But I thought this could certainly be used as a source article for us, because even though it's dated, it is an analysis of variations in registration abuse policies. And then this obviously helped inform current requirements and goes a little bit to what we were talking about earlier with specific types of abuse formerly being forbidden and that being a requirement. And so that essentially gives registrars at least the reasoning and the teeth to take down domain names, since they have those, they're required to have those explicit categories of abuse listed in their policies. But this, if we do look at anything, even if it's a focus group or we're looking at something after the fact, after we have more data about DNS abuse, I think this is helpful for just informing the range of abuse policies you can get from registrars. And then lastly, this last report dealt primarily with botnets. So it was the SSAC advisory on fast flux hosting in DNS. And, you know, essentially as you're with fast flux hosting, you're dealing with botnets that are calling out from local machines to, domain names that can be changing. So even if you take down one domain name, the software knows if it can't find the first one to search for the next one. And so with that, because you're dealing with bad guys who are using algorithms to generate domain names and then buying a bunch of these or registering a bunch of these domain names, and that makes for a highly sophisticated and resilient botnet. But there are, on the other hand, there are known patterns for these types of botnets. And so it would be interesting in looking, once we have this abuse data, to know is fast flux hosting more or less prevalent in new GTLDs. And this could relate directly to whether or not a registrar is at, or a registry is actually taking initiative in their own zone to look for such a thing. And so those are my readings. Does anybody have any questions? Thanks.
Who would like to go next? Brian, microphone.
This is Brian. I've just been confused about it from a technical standpoint. It's used in for phishing attacks. Is that correct? Like fast flux phishing is the term I've heard a lot, but it uses a specific technique.
It can be used in a variety of things, but it can be used. It's especially big with botnets. You can get that. So basically, at some point you would have been phished, most likely, so that you would get the malware installed on your system. And then your system would be calling out to the botnet. But instead of there being one domain name, and that domain name could easily be taken down, what you would have is you could have countless numbers of domain names that were generated using the same domain generation algorithm. So that way the software would automatically know where to look next. And but the nice part about this is that, you know, there are going to be patterns when you see a group or an individual or a group of individuals register a bunch of these domain names that are all off by a letter or a number or whatever the sequence is, whatever algorithm they're using. And so that's how there are, there's lots of papers written on mitigation techniques for this. And so this is something where if you had a registry being proactive about looking for these things, you could see that some zones have fewer than others or whatnot.
No, I think that's interesting. This is Brian again. In some of our conversations with law enforcement building the DNS abuse report, they mentioned these domain generation algorithms as something we should focus our research on as a form of abuse. Another interesting tidbit is we've talked with some professors from the computer science department at the University of California, San Diego, who have what I think is a very interesting study about how this sort of structure and syntax of a domain name is predictive of the amount of abuse you're going to see emerging from that domain name. So it's something that I will look into more because I think it's an important issue. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, I would say we definitely want to look at DGAs as part of our overall abuse study for sure.
Okay. So who would like to go next? No, Carlton will need to step out, so we don't want to break the flow. So, David, okay. You're volunteering, yes?
I was volunteered, yes. So, David, yeah. In my areas of expertise as well is even better. So, anyway, search engine poisoning, SEP. So I went through that very short article, which was lucky. A common practice, as we see there, where we get the goal is to make use of the search engine results to draw the good users to the bad sites where the malware is. That's the main basis of it. And I think the hypothesis I was looking at was whether the new GTLDs were any more subject to SEP than the legacy TLDs, possibly because there's a keyword, we're getting more keywords involved. And this is about keywords, so I thought that might well be the hypothesis which we need to look at. I'd put there in the findings there, trying to get out that paper, but obviously there's a lot more needs to be done than just that paper. And how it works, that you've got the hacker selecting URLs, which are taken from, they've got to be popular domain names, and then they create a huge number of these URLs containing the targeted keywords, which again ties in with some of the new GTLDs, which are keywords themselves. And that goes through, and then basically, you know, you've got an intermediary, and off you go. So if you're going, I think, somebody, if you go to TripAdvisor and you're looking in the comments and you see that and somebody just pumps in there and says, hey, go to this site, this is really good, this will tell you how to do it, that's where you do it, that installs the malware, and then you get sort of caught out, shall we say, which those tend to get taken down from the blogs and TripAdvisor, and you can't put them on. So that was the thing there, and so there, at the end there, the sort of recommendations. I mean, it was really assessing whether new GTLDs are being targeted more than the old ones, what solutions have been put in place, whether there are solutions in place. I don't know, I think it was, XYZ was apparently having a lot of these problems. So again, I don't know whether we, or how we go and find out which ones have the problems and what's being done, but that essentially was where I was going to. And then other things, whether search engines themselves, which is just purely for our Google friend, whether they're avoiding certain TLDs if they identify that this is happening, and that's probably going outside our remit. That in this essence is where I am, but I'd certainly take any comments from all the technical people who will know this better than I. Go, Drew.
This is Drew for the record. Yeah, I think this sounds like a great article for us to look at because I guess there would be the overall question of where new GTLDs are ranking in general in a variety of, I guess, SEO rankings. But then if we found that within that universe there was a high percentage that were bad and therefore part of the search engine poisoning, that would be pretty interesting. So that might be something that we want to bring up in the when we convene as the bigger group and we have our Google expert here because I know he has access to Google's internal research team, and so perhaps there could be some data for us on that.
Thanks. Anything else? Shall I move on? Spoofing. So this is where a malicious party basically impersonates another. You can go about it in a couple of ways. I was looking more on the IP and the DNS rather than the ARP. But again, here the question is whether new GTLDs were more subject to spoofing attacks than legacy TLDs. I think that's the essence. And whether a user can trust the domain name that they're going to, that it hasn't had the underlying DNS spoofed. And then again, the third one, since in the hypothesis, is whether internet users, I've got to read it from here, want to be assured that when they type in a certain domain name, they can go to the right domain name, and again, the DNS hasn't been hijacked. So I think those are the points where there's any difference between the new GTLDs and the old TLDs, and hence they're on the right, considering the vulnerability of new GTLDs, and which ones are offering additional protections if they are offering additional protections, and if they are, to what extent those are successful. So, again, open to any thoughts, comments on that one. None. Moving. Oh, go on, Fabro.
No, just Fabro for the record. This one and the previous ones are good uses of DTLDs to bad practice. But the question I have is how we measure it and how we avoid it. Because every type of analysis I could make is after the thing has been done. So. And then, for example, in the previous, I think there's a cross channel.
Look, I should pour water for some.
Somebody's computer that is hosting right now, maybe. Who's presenting?
This one.
That computer. Okay. That's really weird. There's only one connection to the connect right now.
Is it a Wi-Fi mic or a wireless mic that might give us some channel?
It shouldn't. We don't have any wireless mics attached, so it's...
Well, it sounds like it's coming from somewhere else.
Sounds like a party to me.
Yeah. Something, yeah.
They're probably so excited listening in.
Somebody in the vicinity. No?
Hi.
You're a perfect person to come in here, right?
Oh. Yeah. Must have been Josh.
We had some sort of weird interference.
Ignore it for now. Yeah, go for it.
Yeah. Carry on.
Yeah. The one thing I had in mind is that some measurements we do are post-act, and some measurements are pre-act. So all these two cases are clear measurements we can have post-act. So, for example, in one of the papers I review it, they get, using the WHOIS information, they get who are the ones who are doing the most damage. And you can clearly find them. But if you give publicity to them, it's probably a fake WHOIS or something like that. They just replace it with someone else. And then it would be so hard eventually to get that information. And with new technology, new uses, would be so much more uses. From beyond?
No,
yeah.
there was a...
That would be wonderful to think about metrics for that, but the only thing I can see is academics looking backwards and say, yeah, that happened. But I couldn't find a way to kind of use metrics strategically to monitor that month after month or semester after semester. I'm just sharing a frustration. Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to quantify. I mean, apart from going to the registries that are offering the protection and specifically asking them, which we've got an example then comes with FTLD. So, I mean, again, that's a good example. I'm not sure. So I'll move on to FTLD. So FTLD, they're doing the registry services for .bank and .insurance, and their key thing, which they're underlying, is their enhanced trust. So they set out, and there's quite a bit of paperwork on that and how they have this enhanced trust. So I think the hypothesis there was whether the security requirements which they've put in place are enough to limit DNS abuse. Now, obviously, they're different because they're pretty closed TLDs as well. They're not going to be abused in the same way as an open TLD, but obviously the risk is a lot higher with them. My question is, would it be feasible to oblige all registries to ensure a higher level of security? We had the trust aspect mentioned this morning, the Nielsen, and obviously I think there's arguments as to whether we should or shouldn't try and put something like that or recommend something like that in place, or whether we leave it to the regulated and high risk TLDs. Going there a little bit further on the right, I'd put there for the what we could do study if it's feasible to implement mandatory higher security requirements. And to actually there, I was thinking, because with the GAC, there were recommendations, and we were talking this morning about the just recommendations haven't been implemented, and it strikes me that something we should be going forward potentially as a review team saying that this has been a clear success if we can identify that it's been a success, and isn't this something that should be mandatory rather than a recommendation? Because I find it quite confusing when you speak to people as to who thinks it's a trusted TLD because you're not .com, and then you go, well, it isn't really. It means nothing. And I think that's for me, it's an issue. And maybe we can get some impact or some response from registries as to those who have put in higher security or practices that they're saying, well, this is far better and this has had the benefit and higher registrations, etc. So I put there identify and review other new GTLD registries that have put in place enhanced security. The only other one I really know about is .trust on that, appropriately named. And I put there as well, which was just throwing into the wind, the tenability of a position of prohibiting proxy privacy registration services. Just like to throw that one out because it's one of those things which is an interesting one to debate, shall we say. And I just put consider the recommendations of the WHO's review team, because we certainly wouldn't want to be going down and redoing their work, shall we say. So any comments, thoughts on that?
Yeah, maybe what we can do, because I thought of ways to kind of like higher security requirements, but then for the bank, for example, it can be a bank institutions, but we have the ecosystem that would be really hard to define a criteria to what is bank or not in all of the world. Although I reviewed the Symantec report, and they kind of ranked these ones at the most used for fraud. And with the Nielsen research, we also know that those are the ones the most trusted. The Nielsen report
ranked,
also...
The Symantec ranked .bank as the most abused.
Yeah, the financial ones as the most targeted for abuse.
Targeted.
So it's the most targeted, but not necessarily. I don't know if there's like a conversion rate to
it.
No, yeah.
It's targeted, yeah. So what we could suggest is to create a group of top five. So those who, for reasons ABC, are highly used for attempts to fraud or something like that, they will be constantly reviewed for implementation or re-implementation or metrics. So we don't discuss the criteria itself because it would be crazy for all GTLDs, but we set a small group of ones who are very highly visible for fraud and then we monitor them.
Now, I suppose it also opens up into other TLDs as to if there's a, we can identify TLDs that are abused or attempted to be abused, that if we arrive at a certain threshold, then more security needs to be put in place, for instance. That might be something which I don't think is generally discussed, but something which we could possibly suggest. You know.
Yeah, I might be naive in the way what I'm going to suggest, but we could ask private sector about for inputs on which ones are the most tempted to fraud. I mean, not sure if that will work, but we could find ways to... The thing is, how we set the criteria to what ones are top, use it for mistrust or abuse or...
I'll carry on. So then the other one I'd got was the name collision occurrence management framework for registries. So I wasn't sure about this one, but it's where a TLD is being used on an internal network so that if you fire in a query for that internal network, it could go out to the public DNS. So I know that was a big thing when that came up after the launch. And there's this 90-day period put in place, and I can put this. And this is quite an old document. I think it was 2010. So it was certainly early days there. So the hypothesis really was, you know, did this framework work? Were there examples which showed that collisions were avoided? And there was a terminology of whether there was an emergency situation. If that occurred, then certain things would be done. Now, I'm not sure. I'm sure there is, and someone can tell me there's probably a report on the effectiveness of this somewhere, seeing as that's 2010, but maybe there isn't. If there is, then we might have our answers, and that's fine. We can review the effectiveness of it, and if there isn't, then I'm not quite sure what we do or how we go next. So there the recommendation, whether we'd identify there's any ICANN or registry reports on the effectiveness of this, and then whether things could be improved in the future. So open to any comments on that.
This is Drew for the record. I can't recall now, but how long ago it was. Wasn't it 2 months ago we had a presentation that addressed the specific issue? And so there was recent data on it. And wasn't it one of these things where we've seen no issues for it, and so therefore we don't know if it's a success of the safeguard or if it's because it wasn't the big issue we thought it was. I think this is where we were having the discussion that it was like the Y2K bug. And so maybe you guys remember which month that was. But
yeah, this is Brian. That was a presentation from Francisco Arias. And I believe there's named collision reporting out there that he would have access to. So we can I can make a note to follow up on that. I feel like he's told me about it. Karen, do you remember that?
Thanks. No, I was looking for it, too. I don't recall when it was, but for what I recall from what he said was the number of reports is somewhere around 20 to 30, and that none of them have been life-threatening or whatever the right terminology was. But, maybe we can go back and point you to that recording, because I do recall a pretty interesting discussion about the sort of, preventive effects, which are difficult to measure, and other sort of perspectives on this set of risks and the measures that are in place.
Okay, and then the other ones I had, which I didn't get to, there's the high security zone top level domain advocacy group, which I started working through. That was 48 pages, and I got through to about halfway through, and this was on the flight over, and sleep took over. I'm not saying that was boring, but there was no consensus, but there was different positions, so you had to dig down. And there's some quite interesting stuff at the end as well. So I jumped to the end where you've got a lot of the various entities have put in public comment and seeing where that was going. So that was something which I realized I wasn't going to manage to get through in half an hour. And the other one, which is up there for me, measuring perpetrators and funders of type of squatting, which is an article by Ben Edelman, who's very good, was something I actually wanted to read. And so there was a part of me thought I'd get up this morning and read that, but then the other part of me thought no. But I do actually want to read that one. That's the one that actually hits on my competence level, I suppose. So I will read that one and get back to you on that.
Okay, so it's 3:40, and I don't want to have us launch into the next presenter. So in the interest of recapping, maybe I'll ask both Drew and David just to give a yay or a nay as to whether the articles that they presented on should be a primary source for us or not, because I think that is useful. And also, Alice, I think that goes to our that other category of useful, non-useful, and I just wanted to make sure we capture that as we go along. So if it's just going to be, if the article is just useful as background or, explanation, but isn't going to be useful as sort of a primary source for our review team, if you can just indicate that. That way we can keep an ongoing tally of what our smaller subset of sources are going to be. This is kind of a universe, so to speak, but we're going to be narrowing down to a much smaller solar system here. So, Drew, why don't you start, and then David, you can tag along, and then we'll be ready for our break.
Alice, would you like us to just highlight these green organizationally so that way what we would like to use as a primary and keep as a primary?
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine.
Okay.
Yeah, so in the...
So we could do that instead of...
Yeah, that's fine. So in the Google Doc, if folks can use the red light, green light convention, if it's going to be a primary source, use a green color for the title of the article. And if it and I'll say just do it that way. That way we don't have to do red. So if it's going to be used, just designate it in some green font. Does that make sense? Yeah? Yeah? Okay, good. So it's 3:43. I bestow those extra 2 minutes upon everyone for the break. And we'll come back here at we're going to come back to the other room. So, which Alice, tell us where we're going to be.
Oh.
No, we're not.
Yes, the next meeting is in the forum room, which is just down this hallway and to your left. Just, you'll see it.
So it's forum.
Forum. Mm-hmm.
Forum. So.
Not us again. Just us.
Yes,
it's just us.
Oh, that's just to make this move.
Yes, it's
so
just.
We've already done our exercise.
I'm going to I designate you as my negotiator here, David. So gather what you're going to need, and we'll meet back in the forum room at 4 o'clock.
And later we're coming back here, or we're going to move for the rest of the afternoon?
Doesn't say.
We'll be back in this room to conclude the day.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, that'll be at 5 o'clock. Okay?